Going to begin Sefer Melachim, the Book of Kings. And the Book of Kings obviously comes on the heels of Sefer Shmuel, a Sefer that many of us studied together. And Sefer Shmuel, the history of Sefer Shmuel, so you have Shmuel's entire lifetime, which is 52 years, approximately the last 52 years of the time period of the Shoftim, the judges, right? When the Jewish people come into the land of Israel, Yoshua leads the people for about, I think it's 24 years. And after Yoshua finishes, he passes the baton on to the time period of the judges, the Yemei HaShoftim, which lasts for approximately 400 years. Let's, approximately. So Sefer Shmuel began with 52 years of Shmuel's life, and then 42 years of there being Jewish kings. The first two being Shaul HaMelech, and then 40 years of David. We have 7 years where David was only the king in Hebron, and then 33 years where David was the united king over all of Israel. And so Sefer Shmuel in totality is approximately something like 94, 95 years from beginning to end. We are picking up Sefer Melachim at the tail end of David's reign, and a couple of years, as we'll hopefully see together, a couple of years before the first Beis HaMikdash is built. And Sefer Melachim, Aleph and Beis, something that we make mention of, the division of Aleph and Beis in terms of Sefer Melachim is not a Jewish idea, but it's user-friendly. Much of the division of Tanakh, for whatever reason, we were able to get by without divisions of books into Aleph and Beis and without chapters for many, many years. And it was only when the Torah began to be translated. The Torah was translated into Greek by our Chachamim. That was called the Septuagint, the 70 sages that all got together and they were put into different rooms and they translated the Torah. They translated just into Greek, right into Greek. Right, right. Beryl Wine likes to make the joke that the miracle would have been even greater if they were in different rooms. If they were in the same room and they agreed on one translation, that would have been an even greater miracle. But they only translated, as far as I know, and again, you can do the research yourself. I think they only translated the five books of the Torah. They did not translate the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim into Greek. That did happen later. I don't think it was done by Tamir Chachamim, and I think it was that translation that added the division of Samuel 1, Samuel 2, Kings 1, Kings 2, Chronicles 1, Chronicles 2, Divrei Hayamim. In terms of Chazal, when you open up a Mishnah and a Gemara and they refer to the books of the Bible, they will only refer to Sefer Melachim as Sefer Melachim. Just one book from beginning to end. It's helpful. You can ask your children when they were in elementary school, whatever it is. Eighth grade is Melachim Aleph, and sixth grade is Shmuel, whatever the division is, it works nicely. But from let's say, a Siyam perspective, if you wanted to make a Siyam on Sefer Melachim, it would be starting from the beginning and going until the end. The chapters, we've mentioned this before, the chapters, the fact that we break down all of Tanakh into chapters, the chapter came from the translation of the... There were some translations, I think, between the time that the Torah was translated into Greek. There were translations that translated the Torah, again, from Greek into Latin, as Latin became more spoken amongst people who were interested in the Bible. However, as you know, perhaps from your own research, a translation of a translation is not such good quality. We have that sometimes. That's why certain works, that doesn't necessarily make sense to read them in Hebrew, because they weren't written in Hebrew. You're going to read the writings of Rav Hirsch in Hebrew, so he wrote most of his writings in German. So now it depends. If the English that you're reading is a translation of the Hebrew, so then you're missing something. The best thing would be to translate the original. So at one point, I think sometime in the 300s, the Torah was translated again, not necessarily by Jewish scholars, but definitely by Hebrew scholars, from Hebrew directly into Latin. That's called the Vulgate. That, I believe, that's when they added chapters. It used to be they just divided, the Torah was divided into paragraphs. And right, whenever there's a little space in a Sefer Torah, that's a paragraph. And every book has numerous paragraphs. And the paragraph has to be set. The Rambam writes in the laws of Sefer Torah that if you have a paragraph break in the wrong place, the Sefer Torah is actually pasul. Not only does every letter have to be right, but every paragraph has to be written right. And many times you'll have, right, those are a lot of the famous Rashis. Why is this Parsha next to this Parsha? They're not referring to Parsha Shavua, they're referring to paragraph. Why is the paragraph of Sota next to the paragraph of Nazir? Like, that's probably one of the most famous ones in Bamidbar. So here we're starting Sefer Melachim, chapter 1. We use the chapters because they're just easy, and they help us and guide us. So Sefer Melachim is picking up historically at the end of David's reign, a few years before Shlomo is going to build the Beis HaMikdash, and if I'm not mistaken, the first Beis HaMikdash lasts for 410 years. That's Sefer Melachim. Sefer Melachim is the journey from the beginning of the end of the reign of David throughout the entire period of kings, including the unfortunate division when there becomes a northern kingdom, which is the 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom, which is the tribe of Yehuda and Binyamin, included Kohanim and Levim, and the history of both of those kingdoms simultaneously, looking at those histories individually, looking at those histories when the kingdoms cross paths, the end of the 10 tribes, which the end of that northern kingdom was about 130 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and Sefer Melachim ends with the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and the exile of the southern kingdom to the land of Babel. And there are definitely other books in Tanakh that we're going to incorporate in terms of our study. How extensive, it's a challenge, because the story is told sometimes in multiple places, right? We have a lot of prophets who prophesized about the destruction, specifically Yirmiyahu Hanavi. So when we get towards, we should all live and be well, and you know, no one has to come, but and say from Malachim Beis, as you're heading towards the destruction, you have to kind of take a look at Yirmiyah. What the one Sefer in Tanakh, which we're going to take a look at more often, I'm not going to say every week, but definitely constantly, is Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim tells the story specifically of the southern kingdom, specifically of the Malchus-based David, the Davidic dynasty. It's almost as if the goal of Sefer Melachim is to get you from the high of David and Shlomo to the unfortunate end of the first commonwealth and the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And the message of the Navi is not a history book. The Navi is there to tell us things that are important for us to know from that time period about the, it's kind of sad, but we're going after the time of David and Shlomo. It's mostly downhill. At least in the northern kingdom, it's like all downhill. In the southern kingdom, there's some ups and some downs with an eventual total down. I'm not trying to discourage anyone. You can't sugarcoat the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Although that destruction was only 70 years, which in comparison, it was much better than what we're at now. But Divrei Hayamim focuses only on the southern kingdom, and almost to tell the story more from the perspective of the Davidic dynasty. And so there's sometimes things are lacking in each one, and we'll try to give us a fuller picture. So here we're picking up Melachim, we'll call it Melachim Aleph, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. The Hamelech David, Zakein, Baba Yamim. David was old. He was Baba Yamim. He was on or coming in days, an expression that the Navi uses to describe old age. And Vayichasu Babagadim, they covered him in clothes, Velo Yicham Lo, and it did not cause him warmth. So one of the symptoms of his old age was a lack of body heat and an inability to be warm. The Radak checks us in. The Radak, in his commentary, I guess he's not necessarily assuming that you've kept track of all the years from Sefer Shmuel and you've been reading straight through. The Radak tells us how old David was, that he was Ben Shivim Shana, he was 70 years old, because he was 30 years old when he became king, and he served as king, again, 7 years just in Hebron, plus 33 more in Yerushalayim, so he served for 40 years, so you do the math. And
was he not a well man? Because 70 is not old.
So. Oh, so the Radak continues in his commentary, and the Radak notes that, yes, 70, even on the one hand, 70, David HaMelech writes in Tehillim that 70 is considered to be a lifetime. I never thought about asking the question, is that because David himself I mean, he maybe did not know when he was going to die, but he writes in Tehillim, right, the days of man are 70 years, and with strength they're 80 years. Was he writing that because that was his perspective on life? You know, he felt that his life, I don't know, now I'm just like guessing. We could do research on that pasuk. But 70 was not so old. If you think about the individuals we know in Tanakh, so the two of the most righteous individuals from Sefer Shmuel, we actually have two different examples. We have long life, we have Eli. Eli HaKohen, who was the shofet who raised Shmuel. So the Navi records that he was 98 when he passed away. As opposed to Shmuel, the Navi, I don't remember if the Navi ever said his age, but the commentators note that Shmuel was 52. And similar to Shmuel, old age kind of came on him. The commentators noted that Shmuel led a very rigorous travel schedule, that Shmuel's model of leadership was very different than Eli. Eli was, first of all, the Kohen Gadol, and Eli's model of leadership, he camped himself where the Mishkan was in the city of Shiloh, and anyone who wanted to come to Eli was able to come to Eli and interact with Eli. Eli was very accessible. We see that when, right, he's out and about when Chana comes to Shiloh. He's definitely with the people, but you have to come to him. Shmuel, on the other hand, followed the approach of going around. He had this like annual circuit where he went around the whole country, bringing the judge to the people, as opposed to the people to the judge, and travel as much as travel tires us out. Last week I drove, on one day I drove like 4.5 to 5 hours in one day. I was exhausted, and this is like modern driving with like heat and air conditioning and whatever, music, whatever, you know, actually a shear, but you know, it's all, you know, and it's tiring. Travel back then was very tiring. So the Radak notes that David also, he uses the phrase kaftza olav zikna, that age kind of jumped him, that age kind of came on him, due to his military prowess, due to how much physical exertion. And I think maybe, you know, sometimes it's hard. We tend to look at, it's always hard to view Tanakh because we are so biased. Because we're reading this, first of all, something to keep in mind, I always try to say at least once during a book, it's important that many of us know the end of the story. Many of us know what happens. It's so important when you read Tanakh, to pretend like you don't. Pretend like you don't know the end of the story, and to pretend like you know, and sometimes view a pasuk only from the perspective of the character. Because you know everything, because you've read the end of the story, you know how it works out. But the characters themselves had no idea what was going to happen, and also don't necessarily know what the other characters know. David's, you know, so we tend to look at it with our 2019 mindset. There were other stresses in David's life that maybe, you know, added to his old age. You know, again, that's how we would look at it. We would probably look at someone who leads a stressful life may reach old age, whatever that means, earlier than someone who leads a very, I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was the New York Times, they had the happiest who was the happiest person in the world? He was a Asian Jew living in Hawaii. Somehow, some way, they somehow did a study. He was the happiest person in the world. He had religion. He had Hawaii. You know, he had... So that, again, so the stresses could maybe add to old age. The Radak doesn't say. The Radak puts it more on the actual physical battles. Perhaps we could add that the stresses of having sons rebel against you, the stresses of, you know, going through the period of when he sinned with Bathsheba and the aftermath of that. That possibly could all add that created this idea of Bab Ayamim. The days had come, and David became old. The fact that they covered him in clothing and he's not able to be warmed by clothing, so Chazal are sensitive specifically to that, and they point to two different directions. When we were learning Sefer Shmuel, so specifically the Rishon, the Abar Benel, he very much wanted to focus on a chronological order to the Navi and how each step led to another thing. So if here David is at the end of his age and he is feeling very cold and he's unable to become warmth, so there is a view to kind of maybe more from the chronological perspective that what was happening here was most recently, there was an episode where David made an error in the sense that he asked for a census to be taken in the nation, a direct census, not via means of a token, like a machzit ha-shekel or some type of symbol, but an actual head count. And so there was a plague that came against the Jewish nation. And specifically, there was a malach, an evil, you know, not evil, but an angel who was carrying out this evil punishment, not evil, the punishment from Hashem. And so David saw the angel. In the same way, you know, when you get scared, you could, they're like goosebumps. So the fright kind of almost, it created a chill within David, and that remained with him for the rest of his life. That chill of seeing the malach, of seeing the angel of God, that had this like internal chill that remained. The Gemara Maseches Brachos says that it's a mida keneged mida. It's a corresponding trait. David, in one time in his life, and again, perhaps it's because he was such a great person, that's what we've seen throughout the Sefer, is that one of the things we saw throughout Sefer Shmuel is that it's not an example that we see, obviously, in Sefer Bereishis, that the greater the person is, the higher standard they're held to. Clothing is something that David, at least one time in his life, he showed that he didn't fully appreciate clothing, and that was the episode when he was in a cave. He was in the same cave as Shaul. Shaul was chasing David, right? Shaul was David's father-in-law, who was also chasing David. It wasn't exactly the Moshe Yisro relationship. It was, you know, a little bit toxic. And so David wanted to show Shaul that he had been inside, that Shaul was in the cave to relieve himself from while he was chasing David. And David happened to be hiding in the same cave. And David wanted to show Shaul, I could have hurt you, but I didn't. So therefore, you shouldn't want to hurt me. You know, let's make peace here. Let's not. You shouldn't be against me. Because if I was really an enemy, I would have taken your life. So in order to do that, David cut off a corner of Shaul's cloak, and from a distance called Shaul and said, Shaul, you know, with respect, he didn't say Shaul, but he said Melech, and he said, you know, look at your cloak. I have the peace. Meaning, I could have cut you. Instead, I only cut your clothing. So Chazal and Maseches Brachos say that was not having proper respect for clothing to do that. David could have figured out perhaps another way to do that. And so in the end of his life, David no longer appreciated clothing, and he was very cold. So how do you heat up a person that clothing won't have an effect? There's no electronic blankets. So Pasuk Beis, Vayomru lo avadav. His servants said to David, unidentified servants, which is not uncommon, but I think is something for us to think about. Yivakshu la adoni hamelech na'ara basula. Let us search out, let there be a search for my master the king, a na'ara basula, a young maiden who's a virgin, a young girl who's a virgin. The amda lefnei hamelech, she will stand before the king. Uzehi lo sochenes, she will be for the king as a sochenes. So the translation here says attendant. Art Scroll translation says attendant. Now we have multiple translations. What do we get? What do you have for sochenes? A warmer, right? And you? JPS 1917. What do we got, Judy? Companion. That's what it says? So the Metzios Tzion is one of the commentators who tries to define words in Tanakh, a lot of times based on other psukim, says the word machmemes, a warmer, and it's based on the description, right? Because the pasuk then goes on to say, v'shachva v'chekecha, she'll lie in your bosom, v'cham l'adoni hamelech, she'll warm up the king with body warmth. Now, something that I'm not going to be able to, right, sometimes we're going to ask questions that we don't have answers to, which is okay. We're going to explain that David actually never has an intimate relationship with this young girl. Now you might say it's because of his old age, but the perspective of the Mefarshim is that David had already reached his max of wives and concubines that a king is allowed to have. Obviously hard for us to grasp our minds. According to the Torah, a man is allowed to have two wives. According to the Torah, a king is allowed to have 18. And David had 18 wives. He had, between his wives and what's called a pilegesh, a concubine, he had 18. Now, why it is that the wives that he have could not have performed this service of... Listen, there is a power to body heat. I've never, thank God, been... But they talk about someone, you know, people who have been locked in cars and are, you know, are stuck on the road, that there is an element if you get under a blanket with someone else, hopefully in a whatever kosher way that you can imagine, that there's a power to body heat. So there's definitely something true to that. Why it is that none of his current wives could have done that, I don't have the answer to that question. The commentators do note, and again, this is hard to understand, but, you know, perhaps based on during the time of the Tanakh, so their knowledge of medicine was slightly different than our knowledge. So the Mefarshim all note that a virgin woman will provide more heat than a non-virgin woman.
Why she have to be a virgin?
That there's more body heat. Now, we have some medical knowledge.
But the doctor says he was a doctor.
Right, but I would imagine that doesn't match up in Bisman Hazeh. And I can't, you know,
it's
but
probably more
right. That's definitely their perspective, and that's why these servants are saying let's basically search for such a girl. Now, why you need to search for such a girl? It doesn't, you know. I imagine it's not so. The requirements are not so hard here. We're talking about she just has to be young and she just has to be not married. But you know why it has to be a search, I'm not necessarily sure. And because she's not going to become, we know there is a price to be paid. Being one of the king's 18 wives, so it has some benefits, but it also has some negative in that you're not able to marry anyone else forever, even after the king is no longer alive. So, you know, theoretically, if she would have been one of, you know, if there had been 17 and she would have become one of the king's 18 wives, and she's a Nara Basula, she's young, she has her whole life ahead of her, it wouldn't have been such a good proposition for her. However, she's not an official wife, and she is going to be not bound by those same restrictions.
Does it give her a certain status? Anything positive for her, other than being the king?
I mean, in our 2019 minds, she could write a book, I'm sure, and sell it. She's doing a great chesed, meaning if she does accomplish, she's doing a great chesed. And again, is this, I don't know the answer to this question, and sometimes we give homework. We don't.
There must be something to it, because Yahu wanted her afterwards.
No, right, but I'm saying, but there must be something to it also in the sense that maybe this was done. Meaning, you know, now we have nurses. We have, you know, the visiting nurse service of New York. Right? They come to your house and they do the modern day practice of what nurses are supposed to do. It could very well be that this was normal for people who reached old age and were having a problem with becoming, you know, with clothing, keeping them warm. Maybe this was, again, you know, there are some crazy things, and there are people who will pay to be hugged. There's some professional huggers, people who don't have social interaction and they feel, you know, very good when they're hugged. There are some, again, I've seen, it's real. I think it's crazy, but you could hire someone to come and hug you for like a half hour, and they claim that it's not inappropriate, you know, whatever that means. Again, this might have been part of her, part of normal nursing. So they go ahead and they find her. Pasuk Gimel, Vayivakshu Nara Yafa. Now all of a sudden she's Yafa. That wasn't part of the requirements, but they found a beautiful young maiden. Bechol Gvul Yisrael. Right, they were looking throughout all the boundaries of Israel. Vayimtzu, and they found Etz Avishag Hashunamis. they found a girl named Avishag who was from Shunam. That's a place that will be made mentioned of more than once in our Sefer. Vayivu osa lamelach, and they brought her to the king. So they went ahead and they did the search, and they found her. As far as we know, her identity, there was nothing about her beforehand. There was nothing about her, where she came from or who she was, but they thought she was the best candidate. Pasuk Dalid vahanara yafa ad ma'od, she was very beautiful. Vatila melech sochenes, she was for the melech sochenes, that same word again, which most of us translated as the warmer of the king. Vatishar seyu, and she served him, she probably also became his, you know, direct personal attendant. Vahamelech yo lo yida'a, the melech did not know her. This is yidia in the biblical sense, like when it says vayeda adam as chava, right? He was not intimate with her, which the mefarshim all point out. It was some part of that was practical because her mission was to provide heat, and had he been intimate with her, she would no longer be a virgin, and therefore she would provide less heat. And the other idea is that it was actually prohibited from David, and David understood, again, hard for us to wrap our minds, that 18 wives is what the Torah allows him, but the Torah says he shouldn't have too many wives. Too many wives is understood as 18, because we have 6 wives recorded. In the very beginning of Shmuel Beis, after once he's king, or maybe when he's coming to Yerushalayim, I forget exactly, the Torah records his 6 wives and some of the prominent children, or at least the oldest children from each of the wives, one of whom we're about to be reacquainted with in the next pasuk. And there, the phrase in the Navi is "Vosifa lecha chachena v'chachena," that I'll add to you like these and like these, meaning you have 6. But I'll add to you like these another 6, and like these another 6. And that's considered to be the maximum that a king is allowed to have, which is something that we're going to revisit, hopefully, if you stick with it, in Shlomo's lifetime, how Shlomo went ahead and dealt with this command of the Torah, when the Torah in Sefer Devarim gives the list of the commands of what a king is supposed to live up to. So apparently, apparently this is... It never actually says if it's successful. It never circles back and says, oh, by the way, David, who couldn't become warm, now he's warm. But she's there, she's present, and we'll see her being mentioned again, that she's always in the inner chamber with the king. So I'm going to present the theory that was crafted by a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Alex Israel, who... I don't know if he exclusively, but definitely teaches in the Gush Yeshiva, at least as part of his sharing of Torah. And he has a very fascinating theory in terms of why do we have to know any of this? How is this important? Meaning that David was cold and he needed to be warmed. Why is that? How is that important? The majority, what we're about to shift to in the next pasuk, is that David's son, one of his sons, his next oldest son, who's still alive, is named Adoniah, and Adoniah is about to launch not a rebellion, not necessarily a announcement that he is the one to succeed his father. He's not trying to usurp the throne from David. He's going to try to put himself forward as the heir apparent, and that the selected one of David. So, and that's going to be usurping it because he knows that he's not the one in line. Everyone seems to know by this point that it's supposed to be, or at least the people in the palace know that it's supposed to be Shlomo. And Adoniah is not going to interact with his father. He's not going to ask his father's permission. He's just going to do it on his own. And we're going to see. He's going to be selective about which cabinet ministers does he invite to be part of his announcement and which ones he doesn't invite because he knows they're not going to be pro what he's doing. So this Rabbi Alex Israel thinks that these four psukim are the proper introduction to the quote-unquote rebellion of Adonijah. How so? We saw in Pasuk Beis, it said, Vayomru lo avadav. It said that his servants suggested this almost this beauty contest to find a Nara Basula. It's almost, it almost echoes the Megillas Esther. What happens if you announce what's accomplished? What's accomplished is now they're going to be messengers going into every single town in the land of Israel, announcing the king is old, the king is cold, and therefore it's going to be in everyone's mind that the next stage is coming. The next stage is coming, and David's no longer powerful. David's no longer fit to lead, and therefore the people are going to be very anxious. And therefore, if one son would step forward and said, "I'll be your leader," many of the people perhaps would be more likely to listen to that son and to take hold. Oh wait, there's something in place. Maybe David must have put him there. David's old. If David's old, so. And we all know who the next king is supposed to be. The next king is supposed to be Shlomo. Shlomo, you know, our tradition tells it that he's 12 years old and he becomes king. So here's Shlomo, he's 12 years old. The chances of Shlomo, from Adonijah's perspective, the chances of Shlomo being the vocal one and getting his name out there is very small. So what perhaps these Avadav, who give the idea of the kind of contest, are really on the side of Adonijah. And they're there just to get the message out to the people, the king is old. And they're, you know, if the king is old, there needs to be a next king. And something that I haven't seen people talk, seen Mefarshim talk about, this is the first time that there's going to be a peaceful transferring of power. Shaul did not transfer power to David in any way, shape, or form. Shaul is killed. And then there's a whole hullabaloo over 7 years before the whole country is going to recognize David as the king. The tribe of Yehuda, they're ready to recognize David. The other 11, it takes them 7 years. For a while, they're recognizing Shaul's son. For a while, there's a vacuum of power. And then they're ready to recognize David. But this is the first time that power is going to transfer from one son, from one king, to his son. And who knows how to do that? No one knows how that's done. It has never happened before. From some perspective, you might say that David didn't know how it was supposed to be done, because it seems that David didn't do anything until his hand was forced to, as we'll get to. But it could also be that the people don't know. The people don't know how it's going to be done. And so perhaps when they hear that the king is old, and then they have another, there's a son of the king who's announcing himself that he's the heir, so it's natural that he's probably the one. Why would they be suspicious? So maybe this whole episode is being described just as an introduction to the rebellion or to the story of Adonijah, and then we can understand perhaps why, you know, a little bit better why it's here. So let's continue in Pasuk Hey. Va'Adonijah ben Chagit misnasei lemor ani emloch. So Adonijah, who's the son of Chagit, and if you go back to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Bet, he's listed that she, Chagit, is one of the original six wives, and Adonijah was the fourth child of David. David's first son was Amnon, and Amnon unfortunately had an episode in Sefer Shmuel where he violated his half-sister Tamar, and a few years later, David's third son, Avshalom, killed Amnon. So Amnon, who you would have imagined was definitely the likely choice to be, because he's the oldest, the likely choice to be king, he's out of the picture. Avshalom, who was son number three, Avshalom, who was the son of Maacha, he led a rebellion against David and was killed by Yoav. So Avshalom is no longer. Adonijah is son number four. Who's son number two? Trivia? No testing here. Just trivia. His name was Kilav, and Kilav was the son of Avigail. Avigail, who David had married, Avigail, who had been married to a scoundrel named Nabal, and then she convinced David not to kill her husband, and then she eventually, her husband died, and she married David. So her son Kilav is one of the four people in Tanakh history that the Gemara records Kilav died without ever performing a sin, without ever sinning. There are four people who never sinned. They're all related to famous people. So you have Binyamin, the son of Yaakov. He was famous, but also his father is probably more famous. You have Amram, the father of Moshe. You have Yishai, the father of David. And Kilav, the son of David. And the Gemara goes out of its way to say who they're related to. Rabbi Charlap, shall live and be well, he liked to explain that the reason why the Gemara identifies them by their relative is because their relative are ones who did make errors in life, right? David, Moshe, and Yaakov did make errors on their level, and then they do tshuva, they rise up from their fall, and that's more, you know, it could be that that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu desires more than, and so maybe Kilav is not worthy of being a king because he never sinned, and you have to be more human to be king, or maybe you could look at it as a positive that his mother Avigail, maybe because she was so righteous, her reward was that her son doesn't become, you know, because there's a lot of, it's not easy being king, and as you see, right, Shlomo's life is not peachy perfect from beginning to end, and where the kingdom goes after Shlomo's life, so it could be, so Kilav is out of the picture. He's never really mentioned. He was son number two. So if he's out of the picture, and son number one and son number three are no longer, so Adoniah is son, he's the oldest son. He's one of the original wives. He's from one of the original wives. We know that Shlomo comes from Bathsheba, who's much later in David's time of being king. And so for Adoniah to misnase, to exalt himself and say, Ani emloch, I will rule. So Adoniah has, number one, what does he have going for him? He's the oldest available son of David. Perhaps what you would call the heir, right? There's a whole complicated, right, in Britain, there's a whole complicated system. Who's in line to, and there's a whole system. They know every permutation of who's in the, this is the 17th, you know, whatever. It's okay. I'm one quarter British, so I can say these things. So the Adoniah is the oldest available son. Now he says, Ani emloch, which the commentators note, meaning he's saying, I will be king. He's not kicking his father out. He has a fine relationship with his father. He's not trying to lead a rebellion. He just wants to say that he's going to be the one to lead the king, to be king. Vayas lo, he makes for himself, rechev ufrashim, he makes a chariot with riders, v'chamishim ish ratzim lefanav, and 50 men who run in front of him. He creates an entourage. He creates, hoopla. He now travels in style. He has a motorcade. Who travels in motorcades? Important people, right? When we get on the highway, we're by ourselves. When important people get on the highway, they have a motorcade. I mean, if you have a motorcade, that's great. But he makes himself chashuv by having these individuals run in front of him. Now, what else adds to the quote-unquote ingredients that leads Adoniah to think that he could go ahead and pull this off? So Pasuk Vav. The Navi notes, V'lo atzavo aviv miyamav lemor. His father never made him sad. Lemor saying, Madua kacha asita. Why have you done this? So the Mefarshim seem to understand he never received a lot of rebuke from his father, from David. And therefore, in his eyes, he viewed himself, you know, with, his report card had straight E's, you know, excellent, the behavior, excellent, the everything, excellent. He never received, tochacha, rebuke from his father. So therefore, he thinks of himself as he is a viable candidate. Meaning, had he been someone who his father, you know, said, you're not good at this, you're not good at that, you're not, then maybe he would think, maybe I can't be king. But he went through his life, he went through his life always thinking that he was good. Rashi quotes a language that this comes to teach a person that rebuking a child is a good thing. That a child who goes without any rebuke is not going to end well. Nowadays, they're parents always are very scared to use the word no. I imagine most of you in your parenting, you were very comfortable to use the word no. And nowadays, it's becoming less popular to use the word no. And if a kid never hears the word no, so right, it used to be right when you send your kids to school and a kid did something wrong in class, whose fault was it? It was the kid's. More and more, I can tell you, it's the teacher's fault, which would never have been, right? If I would have come home and told my father that it was a teacher's fault, I wouldn't have. It wouldn't have been good. But things are on whatever. It's different. There was a school. They got in trouble for it because it made the newspapers a couple of years ago. There was a school in Long Island that actually sent out like a directive to its teachers about when it gives grades, they shouldn't give grades that that the kids won't like, kind of thing.
Yeah,
and this was.
It's happening.
And so again, we can have the discussion, but Rashi and Chazal are sensitive that it's not a good thing not to rebuke. And if you remember, echo back in Sefer the beginning of Sefer Shmuel with Eli and his sons, and how there was a lack of perhaps rebuke. Obviously, it needs to be healthy. A parent who always rebukes, so that's not going to be good. Not going to be either. That has to be right. Talks about the relationship that Hashem had. This expression, I forget if it's from Mishlei, where. No. Not only that, the other one I'm thinking is there's one about like to you push with one hand and you pull forward with the other hand. I forgot the exact. I'm paraphrasing. So that it needs to be a balance. So Adoniah grew up with only the bringing close without any admonition, and therefore he thinks very highly of himself. The pasuk continues above the gam, and also meaning another qualification in terms of what he thought about himself. Hu tov toar ma'od. He was very handsome. The oso yalda acharei Avshalom, and he was born. His birth order in the family, he was born after Avshalom, which the commentators note is significant and connected to the first phrase of the pasuk. The first phrase of the pasuk is talking the first phrase of this expression, that he was very good looking and he was born after Avshalom. So one of the ingredients when Avshalom led his rebellion, one of the reasons why Avshalom thought so much of himself and was so haughty to think that he could lead a rebellion was because of how good looking he was. And that there is something to be said for a leader being physically attractive to the people. That was when Shaul was first selected as king, it wasn't in a negative way. The fact that Shaul was described as being, head and shoulders above the nation, you kind of see something. You could be a powerful leader like Napoleon, who I don't think he was so tall. But there probably was something to seeing, to seeing President Lincoln when he was, I think he's known as the tallest president. There's something about physical. We're all, unfortunately or unfortunately, we are physical beings, and we're swayed by physical appearance. Right? I'm not a political historian, but everyone says, right? What was the first televised presidential debate? Was
JFK
and Nixon. And here you had JFK, who was an attractive young man, and you had Nixon, who was Nixon, and the people point to that because now should it be? Shouldn't we only be focused on the issues? But where people are people, and the fact that Adoniah was so attractive, but also the also yalda acharei Avshalom, it's similar to Avshalom. Not only was he in actual birth order Avshalom was child number 3. And Adoniah was child number 4, but he followed after Avshalom in that thinking your physical appearance will allow you or give you license to lead. It could be a piece of it, but it can't be. It definitely can't be all of it. And it's only going to be if God chooses you. Meaning Shaul was described, and David is also described as very handsome. When we were first introduced to David, he's described as very handsome, and it makes sense genetically, right? If David has multiple children that are so handsome, it maybe came from somewhere, at least half from David and half from David's counterparts.
But these two are from the same mother.
They're not. No. They're not actually from the same mother. They had different mothers. The Rashi notes that because this is the fourth wife, she patterned herself after Avshalom's mom, and Avshalom's mom didn't have the best character traits. And so she patterned. So it's being presented, but they're different, right? This is Adoniah's mother was Chagit, and Avshalom's mother was actually a Gioras from, I think, Geshur. Her father was a king in Geshur. Her name was Maacha. She converted. And there, right, at what point she converted, that was the whole, when the unfortunate incident takes place between Amnon and Tamar. So some of the Mefarshim do a mental gymnastic type of activity that maybe they weren't actually biologically sisters, because maybe she was born before her mother converted. It was a whole, maybe they weren't sisters, maybe they weren't brothers, even though it was a terrible occurrence, no matter what, however you explain it. So Avshalom and Adoniah came from separate mothers, but what the Torah is trying to say is, what the Navi is trying to say is either a perspective that Avshalom's way of thinking that he's so handsome was contagious, and that what Adoniah felt, or as Rashi notes, that the mother of Adoniah kind of took the bad lessons that she learned from Maacha and extended it to her son.
Yeah, here, by the way, is the translation
goodly. Goodly in terms of...
He was a goodly man. But it says, doesn't about physical appearance in this translation.
This is very handsome.
Uh-huh. Right.
Toar certainly implies handsome.
Right, so definitely... I think that's a little too limiting. The Mitzudas Tzion, just to read it to you, says, Rotzelamar, Gam ba'avur ha-yofi, chishav shahogon l'malchus. Because of the yofi's, his beauty, he thought to be... But maybe, you know what, maybe they're... Well, first of all, goodly could be appearance, without saying the word appearance. But also, they may be influenced by the first part of the phrase. The fact that it's saying his father never told him anything, that he did anything wrong. So that kind of creates a certain... way that he felt about himself. Now, what does he do? What does he do? We'll just read two more psukim. V'yu pasuk zayin. V'yu devarav im Yoav ben Tsuria v'mevyaser hakohen v'yazru achrei Adoniah. Who does Adoniah speak with? So he selects two individuals, and the way, especially when you read the next psukim, he is, this is direct marketing. He is going after Yoav, the son of Tsuriah, and Avyasar the Kohen. Yoav is David's general. He's also David's nephew. Tsuriah is not his father's name. Tsuriah is his mother's name. And Tsuriah was one of David's sisters. So Yoav was a nephew of David. He had been his general. But why would Adoniah reach out to Yoav? Yoav is probably, we had mentioned this in Sefer Shmuel, I think he's one of the most complex personalities in all of Tanakh, and he clearly was a genius of a person, and very hard to understand all of aspects of his personality. And Yoav saw the writing on the wall. The writing on the wall is that David is probably going to instruct the next king not to have anything to do with Yoav. That David had this dependent relationship with Yoav, that while he hated Yoav and what some of the things that he did, David felt he needed Yoav. But that wouldn't necessarily carry over to the next generation. And so Yoav is prime. Adoniah understands, right? Adoniah understands that if I get Yoav on my... Yoav is easy to get, because he knows that not every son, specifically the selected son, Shlomo, is going to have fond feelings for Yoav. And so if Adoniah gets Yoav, Yoav's one of the keys to the military, because he's the veteran general. Secondly, Avyasar HaKohen. Avyasar is the current Kohen Gadol. He is the current Kohen Gadol. However, Avyasar also knows that the writing's on the wall, because we saw an episode where David reached out to the two Kohanim, One was named Evyasar, one was named Tzadok, and we saw that the Urim V'Tumim, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, it did not respond to Evyasar, but it did respond to Tzadok. And so for Evyasar, the writing was on the wall that he may be losing his position of being the Kohen Gadol. In parentheses, the reason for that was because way back when, in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, the family of Eli was punished, and he was told that your family will lose the position of Kohen Gadol, but it's not happening right away. It takes a couple of generations, and then it shifts from Evyasar, who came from the son of... Evyasar came from... There were two lines of Aaron. Unfortunately, Aaron's first two sons passed away the day that the Mishkan was dedicated, at Aleph Nisan, Vayihi Bayom Hashmini, on that eighth day when the Mishkan was... So Nadav and Avihu passed away. Then there was Elazar and Isamar. So Elazar was the Kohen Gadol after Aaron. Elazar's son Pinchas was the Kohen Gadol after Elazar. Pinchas was the Kohen Gadol during the horrific episode in Sefer Shoftim of Pilegesh Begiva, the concubine that ended up causing a civil war with the tribe of Binyamin. And it happened under Pinchas' watch. And because of that, he lost his line lost being Kohen Gadol, so it shifted. Pinchas, who came from Elazar, it shifted to the family of Isamar, which included Eli, and now it's going to swing back. Because Eli's family lost it, it was going to swing back to that family of Pinchas and the family of Elazar, and it was going to be Tzadok. So Adoniah reaching out to these two individuals who will not have a place in the next administration is perfect, because Adoniah says, well, if I'm king, you will. You'll be my general. You'll be my Kohen Gadol. There's buy-in. Vayazru achri Adoniah. They helped Adoniah. Their helping is, what does it mean helping? So the Radak explains that they became the spokesman. They became the spokesman to try to turn the hearts of the other members, at least in the tribe of Yehuda, if not more. That they became the spokesman for Adoniah. And they, right, it's much better. When Adoniah tries to... Everyone's usually in it for themselves. When Adoniah tries to convince someone to come and join his, to follow him, so because of himself, but now he has people doing it for him. It's even better. Now they're only doing it for themselves, but people don't necessarily, not everyone knows everything that we know, and not everything knows everything that they know. So these are the individuals who he invites, but it's specifically, well, this will be our last pasuk for today, V'tzadok HaKohen, pasuk Ches, Tzadok HaKohen, who's the other Kohen involved in leadership, and the event, the next Kohen Gadol, Ubenayo ben Yoyada, and David's trusted advisor, and also a type of general, Benayo ben Yoyada, V'Nasan Hanavi, the leading spiritual figure of the generation, Nasan the prophet, V'Shimi, Shimi most likely refers to Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera had reasons to try to ingratiate himself to David, because he had erred in the past. The Re'i, the Metzidos David says, Re'i might have been David's friend Hushai, because Re'i is the language of friend. And there's someone named Hushai, who we had seen in Sefer Shmuel, who was a dear friend to David. Vagiborim asher leDavid, the mighty men, maybe that's the list that we saw at the end of Sefer Shmuel. David's very, you know, close soldiers. Lohayu im Adoniah. They were not with Adoniah. Adoniah didn't reach out to them, and they were separate. Adoniah doesn't reach out to them because he knows they're not going to buy in. They're going to either they know that Shlomo is supposed to be king, as Nasan definitely does, or they're not going to take their direction from one of David's sons. They're going to take their direction straight from David. So Bez Hashem, next time we will continue our study of Sefer Melachim.